This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate, then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by the Sympathizer podcast from HBO. From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr., The Sympathizer is the new HBO original limited series based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel of the same name. On the Sympathizer podcast, join host Philip Nguyen in conversation with the cast, crew, and author Viet Thanh Nguyen as they discuss the making of this historic series. Stream new episodes of HBO's The Sympathizer, Sundays exclusively on Max, and listen to The Sympathizer podcast wherever you listen to podcasts.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour, a co-production of WNYC Studios and the New Yorker.
Welcome to the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick.
Today, thank you as well to everyone who's joined us this morning and for your interest in HR1, free speech, and citizen privacy.
Last week on the show, we talked about a bill before Congress known as HR1. It's far from routine legislation. HR1 is probably the most important voting rights law since 1965. And if it's passed, and that's a very big if, HR1 would bring automatic voter registration across the country. It would take on gerrymandering. And it would restore voting rights to felons who have served their time. But there's another aspect of HR1 that we didn't talk about last week, and that's campaign financing. So-called dark money could be dark no more. Political groups would have to make their big donors public. And for those people behind dark money PACs, people like conservative super donor Charles Koch, that provision of HR1 is very bad news. Back in January, before the inauguration, a group of political strategists had a meeting to discuss HR1. Staff writer Jane Mayer got her hands on a leaked recording of that meeting.
When I first heard this recording, I nearly fell off my chair. I have to admit. Gathered together on this call were the leaders of a number of powerful conservative groups. They included a group that was run by Charles Koch, who happens to be one of the very biggest donors of dark money in American history. And with them were representatives from the office of a couple of Republican members of Congress, including Mitch McConnell's office. And one of the people who was on the call was Grover Norquist, who is a longtime crusader against taxes and the founder of a group called Americans for Tax Reform.
The left is not stupid, they're evil. They know what they're doing, and we need to take part of our day, whether we're focused on taxes or spending or whatever piece of the freedom movement we work on, understand that the donor privacy issue is our fight too.
What they're focusing on is the legislation known as HR1, because what it does is provide for disclosure for the first time of donors that are giving more than $10,000 to nonprofit groups if their money is going towards electoral politics. It also requires much more disclosure of ads on television and digital platforms. And for the first time, it requires that people who are giving more than $10,000 to affect judicial nominees, that they too explain to the public who they are so that the public can judge what they might want. Now, this kind of disclosure is a problem for one group of people, which is secret donors who don't want to be known, who for the last decade, for the most part, have funded right-wing organizations and causes. Now, not all the dark money goes only to the Republican side. For the first time in 2020, interestingly, there was more dark money that was being spent by Democratic groups in the presidential election than the Republican ones. For Koch, however, this is really a paramount concern because he's really got an entire political machine that is funded by dark money.
But when it comes to donor privacy, I can't stress enough how quickly things could get out of hand.
Steve Donaldson is a policy advisor to Mitch McConnell.
Grover mentioned earlier how the left has already identified that they want to punish anybody that was involved in the last 4 years. So, well, we have to hold our people together. And this is not just a rhetorical exercise anymore of countering their arguments, but you guys have to actively work to highlight these issues to members of Congress so that we don't lose people on these issues.
It's not uncommon in Washington politics for these kinds of conversations to take place. There is supposed to be a legal line, though, however. These groups, these nonprofit groups, under the law are supposed to be nonpartisan. And here you can hear them conferring and coordinating with the Republican leadership in Congress. And what really makes this call unique is that you're hearing them speak candidly in a way that you almost never do.
Yep, I'm going to pull up just a few slides as a research person. I'm sure you're looking forward to them.
What really grabbed my attention here is the internal research done by Kyle McKenzie of Stand Together. Now, that's a Koch organization. And what they were looking at is how HR1 was playing with the public.
And a little bit of a spoiler, but it's very mixed results on that front. The first thing is simply that you have to understand that most people have never heard of the phrase HR1. So over 60% of people just had no idea what we were talking about when we said, have you ever heard of HR1? However, when presented with a very neutral description of HR1, people were generally supportive. And the most worrisome part, which Grover mentioned at the very beginning of his presentation, is that conservatives were actually as supportive as the general public was when they read the neutral description of HR1. And so this isn't just a matter of like finding conservatives and then activating them on this in a public way. You know, there's a very large chunk of conservatives who are supportive of these types of efforts.
It wasn't just liberal Democrats who believe that there should be more campaign finance disclosure about big money running into politics. What they discovered was that conservatives felt the same way. Their own voters, it turns out, think there should be more transparency and disclosure. So grappling with this, McKenzie is trying to figure out something positive he can say to the other conservatives about how they can handle what for them is a problem.
Don't get into a fight in HR1 where you engage with the other side where they have the talking point. HR1 stops billionaires from buying elections. Unfortunately, we found that is a winning message. That simple message, far and away, resonated with people and you know, riled them up the most. Perhaps most sadly, on the don'ts column here, then this is a major reason we undertook this research, was just to simply test whether the phrase cancel culture could be attached to HR1 and using that to motivate the right. You know, our phrase was something very akin to HR1 is the left's attempt to use cancel culture to cancel conservatives, something like that. And it really ranked in the bottom, obviously for the general public, but even for conservatives as well. For conservatives specifically, we just tested a AOC message that, you know, she has shared publicly that she wants to hold people in the Trump administration accountable. What she means by that is unclear, and we were honest about that in the message.
So this was weird. Why were they bringing up the name of Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez? She's only one of zillions of sponsors of HR1, but I mean, it seemed pretty clear that they just wanted to try to tie her name to this legislation because she's kind of a boogeyman for the conservative movement, and they were hoping that maybe she'd scare off their voters.
It did, you know, move 0% of liberals, as to be expected, and it moved about 31% of Republicans. to kind of change their point of view about HR1 when they were shown this kind of story about how AOC wants to hold them accountable and that HR1 would allow her to do that a lot more easily.
So basically, they can't find an argument that really kills HR1, at least in the public's view, and that includes among conservatives. So then what are they going to do? They're going to give up on the voters' will, and instead what they're going to do is pursue what they describe as under-the-dome-type strategies, which are those under the congressional rotunda's roof, meaning inside backroom strategies where they can put the fix in with Republican members of Congress. Steve Donaldson, though, who works for McConnell, sounds a cautionary note, though.
My big ask to a lot of the groups that are on this call is do not just look at individual component parts and think this doesn't apply to us, or we're okay with this, or we can live with this.
He warns that it's possible that the Democrats, even if they can't get the whole bill, might try to break it up into pieces. He's basically saying, kill any single piece of this bill that looks like it might survive.
Just because one of these bills may seem reasonable to you does not mean that it is not part of a grand scheme to undermine the privacy of your donors and to inhibit the ability of you guys to do what you do.
So what does this all mean? I mean, basically, when you think about it, these old powers in the establishment Republican Party, what they're grappling with is there's change afoot. There's a new mood out in the country, and even conservative voters have gotten to the point where they too think there's too much money in American politics. Whether they're on the left or the right, they're disgusted with the idea that billionaires are buying elections. And there's a kind of a rebellion. And what you can see here is that the powers in the Republican Party, that is people like Mitch McConnell and Charles Koch and Grover Norquist, they really don't care what the public thinks. They don't even necessarily care what their own voters think. They want to stay in power, and they're going to do whatever they can to stay there.
Staff writer Jane Mayer. She's the author of the book Dark Money, and you can find her reporting at newyorker.com. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour, and in a minute, I'll talk with the director David Fincher about his film Mank, which is leading the pack in Oscar nominations. Stick around.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs, because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by the Sympathizer podcast from HBO. From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr., The Sympathizer is the new HBO original limited series based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel of the same name. On The Sympathizer podcast, join host Philip Nguyen in conversation with the cast, crew, and author Viet Thanh Nguyen as they discuss the making of this historic series. Stream new episodes of HBO's The Sympathizer, Sundays exclusively on Max, and listen to The Sympathizer podcast wherever you listen to podcasts.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick.
The first rule of Fight Club is you do not talk about Fight Club. The second rule of Fight Club is you do not talk about Fight Club.
David Fincher made his name in Hollywood as the director of movies that kind of push people's buttons, thrillers like Fight Club and Seven. And he moved on to blockbusters like The Social Network and Gone Girl. All that time, though, Fincher had a special project in his back pocket, a script written long ago by his father, Jack Fincher. It's a movie about the making of movies, a very old Hollywood-style picture, and it stars Gary Oldman as the screenwriter Herman J. Mankiewicz at about the time that he was working on the screenplay for Citizen Kane, and the film is called Mank. Some 30 years after Jack Fincher gave his son David the first draft, Mank is up for 10 Academy Awards, including Best Director. David, from the most parochial point of view, I've got to tell you that I'm sure you made this movie Mank about Herman Mankiewicz because he was the first drama critic of the New Yorker magazine.
Well, that's where it all started.
I went back and looked at it. The reviews are like 2-3 paragraphs long.
Really?
Yeah.
He was a terse guy.
I think when you had that much other activity going and drinking and whatever, you 2 or 3 paragraphs.
Well, the Algonquin.
Yeah.
There was a lot to do at the Algonquin.
That's absolutely right.
Pops, this is Herman Mankiewicz, but we're to call him Mank.
Mankiewicz. Herman Mankiewicz, New York playwright and drama critic.
Turned humble screenwriter, Mr. Hearst.
Why? No need to be humble, Mr. Mankiewicz. Picture's the talk of the future. They're going to need people who honor words, give them voice. There's a golden age coming when all the world will be a stage. And you, perhaps, they're Shakespeare.
Oh, I wouldn't have thought you'd be that keenly interested in the honoring of words.
Now, obviously, Herman Mankiewicz is best remembered as the screenwriter of Citizen Kane, which a lot of people call the best movie ever made, and not that these things are baseball standings or anything like that. Is it, to your mind, the best American movie ever made?
No, but it's certainly up. I mean, again, you know, movies are like wines. You know, it's kind of like things evolve and they change over time. The mostly men who wrote in that era, you know, Hecht and Alexander and Kaufman and Mankiewicz, they were inventing this stuff as they went. You know, here came the writers from the Algonquin and, you know, cameras had umbilical cords that went to the wax recorders. And all of a sudden these movies that you used to be able to swing across, you know, the rafters with some swashbuckler. And now all of a sudden you couldn't do that because you needed to record their voice at the same time. And so the movies had been hampered. And so they went to find people who could make this new kind of entertainment scintillate in a different way. So I think it's not so much that Kane represents the highest attainment of cinematic wizardry. But I tend to think of it mostly as the kind of the first time that real literary conceit kind of merged with a real understanding of cinema and how to present visual ideas to the uninitiated. And all of that held together by the grout of a master showman. And I think Wells thought a lot of the audience. And I think the movie does not play down to the cheap seats. At the same time, it has all kinds of entertainment value for people who just want to see, you know, characters being thwarted and harumphing. So it may or may not be the greatest American movie ever made. It was certainly the first great American film that you could point to and say, this is what it is to fully engage with cinema. Does that make sense?
It absolutely does. I'm trying to, something that is harder for me to comprehend even, is you're sitting here with 10 Academy Award nominations and more deeply the satisfaction of having completed this film and realized it. And it was written by your dad. And the script was given to you in some form or another as many as 30 years ago.
Yeah. Well, the first draft, yeah.
So what's the emotion of that, the fullness of it?
Well, you know, it was a complex relationship to negotiate as far as you know, director to writer. I classically do not see myself as the final arbiter of everything, you know. And listen, I got this from my dad. You know, I have a love of and devotion to the people who stare down the blank page. And I know firsthand how lonely that is. And I know firsthand how potentially revealing and embarrassing that is.
Mank, it's Orson. It's Orson.
Hello.
Mank, I've just finished your first draft, and I must say I'm pleased and impressed.
How are you? Good news.
It'll need work, of course. But there are no problems that can't be solved together.
Well, I'm delighted to hear it.
Houseman's bringing you my notes. Think about them. Meantime, I'll run everything through my typewriter.
Everything will thank you.
I understand you're in touch.
And so I feel very much that my involvement has to be cinematic midwife, you know, or you know, it's an act of interpretation, but there's a huge amount of investment in it.
But you're interpreting something that your father wrote a first draft to. You're in essentially in creative conversation with your progenitor.
Yeah. And not always the most polite.
Yeah. So what's that like?
I don't recommend it. You know, I think there are easier, look, I had and still have an enormous amount of respect for Jack. And
Jack Fincher, your dad, who was a writer for Life magazine. Yeah,
exactly. He was responsible in major ways for my outlook on cinema and storytelling and the movies and interpersonal relationships. You know, he was a model in a lot of different ways. That, unfortunately, did not save us from having, you know, a lot of, you know, arguments about what's the best way to tell something. You know, there we had a lot of conversations. You know, I think that the Rita Alexander thread of you know, the stenographer who is married to a fighter pilot in the Second World War, who is lost at sea off Norway. I mean, I had to take him aside and say, are you telling me that we're going to introduce this woman in a 3-page monologue of backfill exposition when she's been traveling in a car with them for 4 hours to get to Victorville? And he was like, Dave, this is how these movies kind of played out. And he, you know, would just say, Dave, get off your high horse. This is, we're doing something anachronistic, which is, you know, a little bit why I chose that we trapped the movie in a kind of black and white mono aspect, because it helped to sort of codify the anachronism.
Like a clairvoyant. Rita Alexander, Herman Mankiewicz.
How do you do, Mr. Mankiewicz?
That's a big question.
Well, since you like working nights, Rita here runs on London time. Her husband is one of our bold lads in the RAF. Flies, what is it, Rita? Spitfires?
Hurricanes.
My sympathy and prayers.
And I beg your pardon?
Given the speed, climb, and turning radius of the Messerschmitt Bf 109.
I hope we won't need your sympathy, Mr. Mankiewicz. We'll do the praying and do the fighting.
I will meet with Orson weekly.
I know you know this question is coming like Christmas, but so here it is.
Uh-oh.
So in the late 50s and into the 60s, French filmmakers and critics touted what was known as the auteur theory. It's basically a film is the projection of a creator's singular personality, whether it's Godard's Breathless or it's Howard Hawks' Bringing Up Baby, in fact, retroactively.
Yeah.
And then along comes Pauline Kael, the New Yorker's film critic in 1971, and she writes a long piece for the magazine called Raising Cain.
Right.
And she argues that Orson Welles essentially stole credit from Herman Mankiewicz for Citizen Kane.
It's ridiculous.
And that Herman Mankiewicz deserved much more credit for that creation. And your movie is about the creation of Citizen Kane. And I wonder where you land on that question of Welles as auteur or the Pauline Kael argument that Mankiewicz deserved so much more credit.
Well, listen, Pauline Kael was a wondrous intellect and a fantastic fan of cinema. What Pauline Kael didn't know about the making of movies could fill volumes. and I would argue that...
Well, flesh out what you mean by... What did Pauline Kael not know, for starters?
That there's a third... Listen, as the arbiter of everything that's going to go in front of a camera to be recorded in a dramatic, chronological narrative, all of those things are going to be revealing of your subconscious and your belief system and your aesthetic. That doesn't necessarily mean that this thing springs from your forehead fully
realized.
Mm-hmm. It springs from your forehead as a mess of afterbirth that has to be cleaned off and assessed and look, you know, and this thing has to be raised. You know, it doesn't just, it has to be.
But it seems like you're arguing neither for the auteur theory of a kind of singular totalist view, nor are you arguing for the Pauline Kael version of things.
A creation like that is a massive bowl of spaghetti. and combing through it to attribute, you know, anything to a single strand is absurd. I always feel there's so much blame to go around. I've never really understood the idea of fighting to get one's name on something or fighting to get something attributed singularly to your storytelling sensibility, aesthetic, behavioral, editorial function.
I may be a loose cannon, but you, my friend, are an outsider. They're exasperated by me, and I've earned it, but you, a self-anointed savior hyphenate, they're just waiting to loathe you.
Remind me never again to work with a washed-up alcoholic.
Duly noted. Nelson Algren, please copy.
All right! No doubt you'll get your credit, but ask yourself, who's producing this picture, directing it, starring in it?
That's just what we need when Susan Leaves came. An act of purging violence.
David, we began our conversation, we were talking about Citizen Kane being or not being the greatest American movie ever made, and you indicated you think it's not.
It's up there. I mean, it's in the top five or six, but you know.
But if it's your last few hours on Earth and you're going to spend it watching a movie, what is it going to be?
Oh, God. Movies are far too precious to me. And there are so many that are, I couldn't tell you. There are certain movies that I go back to. I mean, Chinatown is one of those movies. All the President's Men is one of those movies. Jaws. I mean, there are movies in the last 80 years that attain that thing that Kane did and shocked everyone. And you have to factor in that a 25-year-old is at the center of this three-ring circus when this movie lands fully formed for world audiences. That sets it apart. You know, maybe it doesn't set it apart from Jaws, but it certainly sets it apart from, you know, All the President's Men or Chinatown. You know, he'd done it a while.
You ask me what my acceptance speech might have been. Well, here goes. I am very happy to accept this award in the manner in which the screenplay was written, which is to say, in the absence of Orson Welles.
How's that?
How come he shares credit?
Well, that, my friend, is the magic of the movies.
Hold up, Oscar, mate. Think, smile.
David Fincher, thank you so much.
Oh, Dave, no problem.
David Fincher's Mank, with a screenplay by the late Jack Fincher, is nominated for 10 Academy Awards, and it's on Netflix. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. Stick around.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
Welcome back. I'm David Remnick. With the IRS filing deadline extended until mid-May, most of us will keep ignoring everything having to do with taxes for at least a few more weeks. Most of us, but not all.
I think of the Internal Revenue Code, which is the document that has all the tax laws in it, as a puzzle. And I like puzzles.
Dorothy Brown is a professor of law at Emory University, and she's an expert on the tax code. Brown has just written a book called The Whiteness of Wealth: How the Tax System Impoverishes Black Americans and How We Can Fix It. What Brown argues is that the racial disparities we see in so many facets of American life, from higher education to homeownership to employment, all are compounded by the tax code, a system that you might have thought was totally race blind.
I've spent 25 years doing this research, and it's led me to one conclusion, that when white Americans and black Americans engage in the same activity, tax law benefits how white Americans engage in it and disadvantage how black Americans engage in it. In other words, we bring our racial identities onto our tax returns.
Brown recently spoke with staff writer Sheila Kolhatkar, who covers finance and the world of business.
One area you talk about a lot is marriage, and we know that policymakers in Washington always say that they're eager to encourage marriage, and
yes,
getting married is supposed to help your tax bill. What did you discover when you looked into this?
What I discovered is it helps you if you're white, but it disadvantages you if you're black. And what do I mean by that? Well, white people do marriage differently than black people in America that is based on an anti-black labor market. When we look at who makes the highest wages, who makes the lowest wages, we see there's a difference by race. Well, that translates into who can afford to have a spouse to stay at home and work at home and stay out of the labor market? Typically white Americans. Well, our tax laws in that instance, where you have dramatically different income contributions to the household by spouses, that household, when they get married, gets a tax cut. But take my parents. My father was a plumber. My mother was a nurse. They made roughly equal amounts. And as a good daughter who got an LLM in tax, I did their tax returns. And I always knew something didn't make sense. My parents made income close together. Our tax laws do not give that couple a tax cut. Our tax laws made my parents pay higher taxes because they were married to each other.
So it turns out that a very wealthy, usually male spouse with a high income who has a stay-at-home wife is going to end up paying lower taxes.
Yes.
Even though he makes the same amount of money as your parents combined.
That's right. And it's true up the income scale. Black married couples, even at high income levels, are more likely to be in an equal 50-50 household, whereas white married couples are more likely across the income spectrum to have the stay-at-home spouse.
I thought it was really interesting as well, the way you talked about the enormous economic benefits that accrue to a family when there's one spouse at home full time. And I thought about this because I'm part of a, you know, dual working couple.
Yes.
You have to outsource a lot of expenses. And if you have one spouse at home just dedicated to making the family run, then the other spouse can focus on building their career and increasing their income.
That's exactly right. That is exactly right. And the tax law looks at the value of those services contributed by that stay-at-home spouse. It's then, nah, we're not going to tax it.
You write about the role of legacy transfers of wealth and assets in building wealth, how families pass down gifts, tuition payments, inheritances to their kids, and this perpetuates this sort of wealth advantage that white families have. Can you describe what you found when you looked into this?
So, you know, it's complicated, but generational wealth begets generational wealth. And tax law helps those with wealth transmit it to the next generation. And what we see is that's how wealth works for white Americans. It's from parent to child, grandparent to grandchild. But because of systemic racism, because of Jim Crow, what you see is the typical Black college graduate who gets a good paying job is sending money up. They're sending money to their parents. They're sending money to their grandparents. So you see that race matters greatly into who has wealth, how the government allows you to build wealth, and then tax policy comes and says, oh, give it away. It's tax-free.
There's a great quote in your book, increasing access to a system designed to build white wealth will ultimately not work to build Black wealth. So why is that? Why can Black Americans not use this system to change their situation for the better?
So let's take home ownership, right? Because that's like the asset that helps most white Americans become middle class. Well, the home ownership market is racist. It's based on white preferences, and white Americans do not want to live in neighborhoods with too many Black Americans. As a Black homeowner, I'm going to say, I want to buy a home. If I buy a home in an all-white neighborhood, it will be a great financial boon, and it will help me build wealth. However, living in an all-white neighborhood for a Black person means our neighbors may call the cops on us because they don't think we belong there. If we have children, we have to do battle with administrators and teachers who see our children as criminals. So it'll be a good financial investment, but you'll have to compensate for living in an all-white neighborhood in other ways. So I have to be defensive. And my advice that I give to Black homeowners is, okay, you know this, then don't be house poor. Do not put all of your money into your house. So we as Black Americans, we can't build wealth in the carefree manner that our white peers can.
That's really depressing because we've been told for so long that that buying a house is sort of the cornerstone of a family. That's how a middle-class family is going to build over time and leave something to their kids.
Yes.
And it's remarkable when you think about how it actually works on the ground.
Absolutely, Sheila. And what's really amazing is how many people don't realize this and how many policymakers think, oh, we could fix this racial wealth gap if we just increased the number of Black homeowners. And I'm like, hold up, wait a minute. Not really, because we're buying into a system that's anti-Black. Until we fix the system, you can't build up wealth the exact same way. And one other thing, Black homeowners are more likely to sell their home for a loss than white homeowners. And tax law disallows losses on the sale of homes. And yes, it's depressing.
It is depressing.
I wrote the book.
Yeah, the system is obviously broken. It does not take into account the world as it actually is. So what are the solutions? Like, what can be done about this, given that the system is so broken?
Step one, collect and publish race and tax data. The IRS doesn't collect and publish it. And I had no idea when I embarked on this journey that the IRS didn't do it. We need IRS data by race so that we can see what I wrote a whole book about. There it is. So that's one thing. Number two, any tax reform out of the Biden administration needs a racial impact analysis. It needs to tell us, what is this bill going to do to the racial wealth gap? What is this bill going to do to Black Americans? What is this bill going to do to Americans of color? So that's the second thing. No tax reform without a race analysis. And in terms of specific tax reforms, you know, I've got a whole tax system which gets us back to our roots, which is basically progressive tax system, no exclusions, no deductions, because those are the things that advantage white Americans and disadvantage Black Americans. And we have a living allowance. Anything you make under that, the government writes you a check. Anything you make over that, that's going to be taxed. And all income is taxed the same, whether it's income from stock or income from labor.
To some people, that's going to sound like a radical idea.
Oh, thank you for saying that, especially the latter one. So the reason I love it is because Ronald Reagan, you know, that radical guy, he had at the centerpiece of his 86 Tax Reform Act, taxing wages the same way as income from capital. And if it's good enough for the Gipper, it's good enough for us.
So one thing you talk about is the fact that white Americans often are not open about the advantages that all these sort of gifts and supports that they get bestow to them, and that the way they accumulate. So why is that important? Why is it important for people to really be open about the fact that they're getting these sort of tax-free gifts, that their grandparents are paying their kids private school tuition? What effect does it have when they sort of pretend or just don't acknowledge those sources of income?
It's so important, because you could imagine a Black and white coworker working in the same place, and now we're going to suspend disbelief and assume they're paid the same, right? Research shows they're not, but we're going to assume they're paid the same. Black person who has family to support, in addition to their immediate family, grandma, parent, is sending money up. Their colleague in the next cubicle is talking about the rich private school their kids are going to. They just moved to a fancy house in an expensive neighborhood. And the Black worker is going, what on earth is going on? Why can't I do what? By telling the truth, it helps Black Americans see we're not doing anything wrong other than we were born Black. And it helps white Americans see they're not doing anything right other than they were born white. So what white Americans resist, and quite frankly, none of the white Americans interviewed for my book wanted us to use their last name because they didn't want to be associated with this, right? But it burst the bubble of this meritocracy. So it's really important that white Americans are transparent about the myriad of ways their family wealth has helped them to get where they are today. And they don't want to think of themselves as racist. And you don't have to be racist, but you did make the choice to buy in a neighborhood with no Black people. And it didn't occur to you until I had this conversation that maybe you're part of the problem, right? So I've gotten some pushback. In fact, it often comes in the form of, well, Dorothy, do you think Congress was racist when they put these laws into place? And my response is, it is irrelevant to me whether it was intentional or accidental. The bottom line is Black taxpayers are paying more. Now that you know, what are you prepared to do to fix it?
That's Dorothy Brown, a professor at Emory University. Brown's new book is called The Whiteness of Wealth. And she spoke with The New Yorker's Sheila Kolhatkar.
Hello? Yeah. Testing. Testing, 1, 2, 3. It works.
Well, the one we've been reading most recently, do you want to talk about the Mysterious Benedict Society?
I can kind of explain it. I'm not very good at explaining books than I am as reading.
But it's called the Mysterious...
Yeah, the Mysterious Benedict Society.
And what is that?
What is that, he says?
It's a book.
David, come on.
What a knucklehead I am.
Yeah.
Danielle Alarcon is an acclaimed fiction writer and a journalist, and he's reported on Latin America for The New Yorker. But I called him recently not to talk about writing so much, but about what he's been reading.
Okay, so a year ago, yeah, everything in my life changed. I used to teach a couple nights a week. I used to travel a lot to either report or give readings or do things like that. I used to play soccer in the evenings. All of that changed. All of that stopped, of course. And I was stuck at home with this, you know, bright, inquisitive 7-year-old. So I just started, you know, doing the thing that parents do, which is to read to our kids. And I think like the first book that we read that I enjoyed reading as much as he enjoyed hearing was a book called Zorga Mizu.
Zorga Mizu, I don't know that one.
It's a poem. It's a long novel in verse. And I just got really into the performance of it. And that's the thing that was fun for me and has been fun for me is like doing the voices, doing the dialogue. Zorga Mizu is a crazy adventure story like all these books are. The protagonist is a young girl, you know, drawn into another universe. But I just got really into it, you know, like I would just the cadence and the bounciness of it and just dig the rhythm of it. Here's a story that's stranger than strange. Before we begin, you may want to arrange a blanket, a cushion, a comfortable seat, and maybe some cocoa and something to eat. I'll warn you, of course, before we commence, my story is eerie and full of suspense, brimming with danger and narrow escapes and creatures of many remarkable shapes, dragons and ogres and gorgons and more, and creatures you've never even heard of before. In faraway places, there's plenty of those, and menacing villains to tingle your toes. So who doesn't like...
A kind of a Seussian rhythm there.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. You know, I used to give readings of my own work, and I enjoyed it. I think it's fun being in front of people. And now I had like an audience of one, but I just got really into it.
Dan, you had another pick?
I did, yeah, I did. We read early on this book called El Defo, which is a graphic novel by a woman named Cece Bell. And I liked it for a number of reasons, but essentially the story is of her losing her hearing as a young girl. She had meningitis at age 4, you know, this challenging new situation where she couldn't hear anything and had to wear a special hearing apparatus. For her in the 70s, it was basically like you know, putting a cassette recorder around her neck, like wearing it like a necklace and having a microphone she had to carry everywhere and a headset. And in order to sort of like deal with this new reality, she, you know, she kind of created this superhero in her mind called El Defo. And it's really funny and very moving, sort of how she identifies with this superhero and how she uses that superhero's personality to turn, you know, a disability into a superpower. It's really great. Really great.
The exercise is called Pick Three. So what is the third book that you really treasure reading to Eliseo?
The last book I wanted to mention is called The Wild Robot. The Wild Robot is essentially this tanker ship full of robots, like runs aground, sinks, and drops a container full of robots that wash up onto an island. One of them survives, turns on somehow, and is trying to understand its new surroundings, trying to figure out what it is, if it's an animal, if it's where it belongs in the universe of beings that inhabit this island. And on the island, animals also don't know what to make of the robot. Eventually, the robot sort of becomes one of them, becomes wild, It's a magical book because it talks about sort of this interface between technology and nature, and also very moving. Not to give any spoilers, but that's not true. I'm going to give a spoiler, but there's a specific reason I'm going to give a spoiler because it's so moving to me. It was the first book that Eliseo really wept at. Honestly, he he was so moved by it, and I was so moved by it. I was like, my voice was breaking as I read the end. When the, you know, the robot has some kind of homing signal that the technology company can hear, and they come for him in this like sort of like idyllic, you know, island paradise. And at that point, the robot has the choice. You know, he knows that they want him. They want the robot. They don't want anyone else. The animals who've come to love him want to protect the robot. And he instead decides to basically turn himself in order to protect them. And at that point, it, you know, it's just waterworks in our house. It's a really lovely book. Really lovely.
It's amazing to think that kids cry from books, that they're so deeply moved, and despite the power of the screen, that a book can really reach down that far still.
Yeah, and I think we've been all fighting, you know, during this pandemic to try to against the primacy of the screen. You know, it's everywhere. It's how they're doing school. It's how they're seeing friends. It's a constant. And, you know, to be able to find books that are, you know, page turners and moving and you know, and teach you something without being didactic, and entertain, crucially entertain, and make the kids laugh, you know, and feel things and think about things. It's just been a joy. It's just been a joy. And all those hours that I've spent with him, you know, I don't think that I'm not going to look back on this year fondly, but there are things that I will remember, and reading with my son is one of them.
Daniel Alarcón, who is a novelist, short story writer, a radio broadcaster, and a writer for The New Yorker. Daniel, thank you so much.
Thanks, David. Appreciate it.
You can read everything that Daniel Alarcón has written for us at newyorker.com. That's it for today. Hope you're getting a chance to take in these very first days of spring. See you next time.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker. Our theme music was composed and performed by Merrill Garbus of Tune Yards, with additional music by Alexis Quadrado. This episode was produced by Alex Barron, Emily Botine, Ave Carrillo, Rhiannon Corby, Kalalia, David Krasnow, Gofen and Putubwele, Louis Mitchell, Michelle Moses,
Annabelle Bacon,
and Stephen Valentino, with help from Allison McAdam, Meng-Fei Chen, and Emily Mann. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported in part by the Chirina Endowment Fund.